humans and animals sometimes morphed into a single creature. Sculptures inspired by dreams. The newest exhibitions at the Weston Art Gallery in downtown Cincinnati feature three artists who bring distinct perspectives to their work with clay. This is Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about those exhibitions are artists Julie Byrne, Pamela Hignight, Richard James, and Weston Art Gallery Director Michael Goodson. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael, you are a relatively new director at the Weston Art Gallery. The gallery's first director, Dennis Harrington, retired this past summer. You've assembled this group of figurative artists working in clay for these exhibitions. Tell us about the exhibit.
Well, it should be said that the show was actually conceived by Dennis Harrington. I'm executing an entire year of Dennis's curatorial endeavor before I begin in the fall of next year. But I think he had the great forethought to bring these three artists together because they represent collectively and individually a kind of comment on how work with clay is incredibly diverse. All three sort of fold into their practices other concerns, other materials, other craft histories, I would argue.
Well, and some of the earliest representations of the human form were fashioned out of clay. As ceramic artists, I'm wondering, do any of you think the medium really lends itself particularly well to the human form, to the figure?
Yeah. Clay is a slave to any endeavor. You can make it do absolutely anything. And so it's sometimes, in early form, sometimes it's kind of rough and crude. You look at the ceramic history, and even people working now do amazing things with clay. It can do absolutely your most profound bidding.
That's a great point, Julie. Pamela, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, we come from the dust of the earth, so I think that definitely lends itself to being modeled in clay.
Well, Richard, you have such figurative work in clay. Do you think the medium lends itself to those ideas?
Yeah, I do. It's been used extensively throughout history. And I do like the hubris of performing godlike activities of bringing humans out of dirt, you know. Yeah, like she said, it's a slave. It's whatever you want it to be, which is also can be daunting, I think, which is why I often use found objects to kind of bounce my ideas off and figure out where my end point is, I guess, the finish line.
Julie, in your work, humans and animals are intimately connected. Sometimes they're morphed together. You've said that your work starts out as a story or ends up as one. Talk about the emotional link that ties your work together.
Several years ago, I invited my mother to the studio, and she was actually suffering from ovarian cancer, and I felt terrible. She hadn't been in a long time, but I realized I had asked her to walk up three flights of stairs. And it was to see a gathering of pieces that was headed to the Rife in Columbus, Ohio, which is the Ohio Arts Council gallery there. She walks into the room, and she's looking at each piece, and finally she kind of folds her arms and says, "Why does everything you make look like me?" And I've thought about that, but I've also thought that all of the animals that I use are actually us too. And maybe in the end, they're all me, or at least embody all of the vulnerabilities, the hubris, the greed, the selfishness, the generosity that we bring to the table.
Who was it? Was it Tesla that said every accusation is a confession?
There you go. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Richard, when we first walk into the ground level of the Weston Gallery, there's this monumental sculpture that captures us. It's mm-hmm. this man of clay with rope wound around his body. Tell us about that sculpture.
Well, it's actually straw, you know, and that is the first collaborative piece with my partner, Emily Shelton. So she actually did all the weaving. My son spent a lot of hours sorting straw as well. It's kind of a basket technique. Mm. And that was the first conceived piece for the show. I was thinking a lot about just the landscape of the art world and the political world and kind of those overlapping. So No Two Scotsmen is a logical fallacy, I guess you would call that. I forget the name of the philosopher now that coined that, but it's kind of a way to exclude any new information into an argument that might prove that wrong. I think the example is no true Scotsman would eat breakfast at this place is what he uses in the book. And the guy can say, well, I'm a true Scotsman and I eat breakfast here. Well, that makes you not a real true Scotsman, right? So, and I didn't want to beat it over the head with like it being a straw man, but I did want that subconscious connection to the material to be there. And for it's not to be big because it's cool to make it big, but because I want it to be overwhelming and hard to get away from and hard to kind of wrap your head around that whole thing, right? Most mark has multiple meanings. There's another meaning that's a little more controversial maybe in that I won't go into, but it's there, you know? So that kind of keeps me honest when I'm making work. It's not just a one-note thing. I think if you can make a work and you can explain everything about that, you're illustrating an idea. And for me, artwork is something that is like sui generis and kind of creates its own energy and tells you as much as you're telling it in some way. And like one note stuff usually doesn't make it out of the studio.
Our producer, Celine Reeder, saw echoes of the Buddhas that were carved into the cliffs of Afghanistan that have since been destroyed. Was any of that kind of in your mind when you created that?
Well, I'm an ex-Baptist, so religion runs deep in all of my work. The response to that, I think. In fact, in grad school, I started using mannerism as a tool for propaganda like it was, except to go the other way against religion. So I think all of those historical connotations and maybe hints of a smell of some kind of historical thing in there is good for the work, I think. If you're making work and you're telling people what to think about something, that's a one-way conversation. So I want to just leave kind of, I don't want to know it. You know, I don't want to have it figured out either. I want people to spend some time there and kind of figure out what it is they think about what is in front of them.
We're talking in this recorded interview about new exhibitions at the Weston Art Gallery in downtown Cincinnati. Pamela, there seems to be an element of kind of a folk art technique of memory jugs in some of your sculpture. A lot of your sculpture includes assembled objects. Describe your work for us.
I start out with an idea, and I start creating the piece, making the armature. I don't usually start out with sketches. I just let the piece kind of naturally evolve as I create, and ideas come to me as I progress in the piece. I'm really in love with my material, which is an air-dry paper clay that I made in grad school. And I can embed things into it and add wet onto dry. And it's just, it's like I said, it's air-dry. So it's amazing stuff. And with the pieces that are the archetypes were definitely inspired by Victorian memory jugs. So it's about our memories and things that we have in common. And we all have shared memories, whether it's of religion or family times together, certain things like swinging on swing sets. I mean, a lot of us can identify with things like that. And a lot of Jungian archetypes, too. I'm really into fairy tales and stories, legends that tie us together as a culture, as a people, through generations. So my work is more about what ties us together.
Mm. And what were memory jugs used for historically?
In the Victorian era, people would gather objects of a loved one who had passed away and embed those objects onto the surface of a jug using a cement type of mixture. So it's like in lieu of photographs, it was things that belonged to the person that they wanted to remember.
You mentioned Jungian psychology that feeds into your work. Talk to us about this collective unconsciousness that's part of your figures.
The collective unconscious, there are things that, like in our dreams and stuff, that connect us. I taught a whistle project when I taught in the schools. And whistles are one of the things that different cultures throughout time have created, even though they had no connection with one another. Those cultures were thousands of miles apart. But something inside of them made them create that instrument within a certain time period that was pretty close to one another. And so I think the collective unconscious kind of feeds us through dreams and just creative, just imagination and just daydreaming and things like that. It's just something that connects us.
Julie, the anxieties and concerns that go into your work feel pretty prescient at this moment. You've talked about war, political polarization, even concerns over parenthood and how those are influences in your work.
And religion.
Talk to us about some of the pieces in the exhibit that really reflect those ideas.
I think they all reflect those ideas on some level. My process is that I end up with something I can't quit thinking about. I'll draw about it, then I'll figure out how to move it on to a 3D. I also should point out that hearing Pamela speak about her process, that's amazing. And I don't allow myself, for a variety of reasons, I like to come in, know what I'm going to do, and I do that thing. And of course, it always changes through the process, but that's my first adrenaline, is to just have this idea that I need to see take form. I have a lot of family, and for me, very often my process is an intimate one. I hope it doesn't seem so intimate. No one else can enter the conversation with it when they encounter it. But it's a great way for me to process things more comfortably than I would if I had to use the tools of confrontation. In fact, I was going to have the postcard shown on a wall, a vinyl. The city of Columbus has money for vinyls in the downtown. And I think once they heard the title, they decided it was incendiary. And the title of that piece is Eat Your Tweet. I don't tweet. I was kind of quoting someone who does tweet, or thinking about someone who did tweet a lot in that period of time. So, yes. So sometimes I just get something in my head that is bugging me, and I'll figure out how then to use that as fuel.
Well, and Pamela, when you hear Julie talk about her process, how do you think of how that differs from what you do and how you approach your work?
Well, I start out with an idea, but I don't put anything down on paper. For me, I need to get in the studio. I need to be working. I'm a kinetic learner, and so I'm a doer. So I need to get in there and get my hands wet and start working with the material, and that feeds my creative process.
I think that is one of the reasons for this influx of clay work that's happened in the last 20 years, maybe, is that because I'm a professor at Miami University, and you see people who attach the clay from like different walks of life, and there's engineers and there's nurses and there's the traditional art people. And clay is very adept at being able to be worked in different ways, like your type A and your type B can both find their ways into that, and you can have a plan, you can kind of fill it out, and clay can also be very unruly and unforgiving in ways that you finish that. So in that sense, it's always kind of like pushing back and talking to you, and it can be a very meditative way. It can also be a very intuitive ABEX painter type experience in the studio as well.
Yeah.
I think that's why a lot of people kind of flock to that, and has like a very strong community nationwide.
Pamela, your material is this paper clay that you've developed, and it sounds like it's almost a marriage of clay and paper mache. What's that like, and how does it lend itself to the root forms you use as armature and the work that you do?
The material is based on a recipe by an artist named Clyde Connell. I discovered her work back when I was in grad school, back in the mid-90s. And she would make this paper clay out of just newspaper and Elmer's glue all. And so I started playing with her base recipe because she couldn't get it to like form over top of chicken wire or anything. So I wanted more versatility with the material. So I started adding a lot of different things to it. And I came up with a lot of different concoctions, but it was play. And the final material has, it's recycled, it's newspaper, dryer lint, it has moist clay and type 1/2 wood glue. And so I mix it up in large batches. And with the kneading process, which does work out a lot of aggression at times, it becomes very, very clay-like. So I can manipulate it and sculpt with it and put it over top of anything.
I love the idea of being able to do something with all that dryer lint, too.
Oh, yeah.
Richard, you use this doll format in a lot of your work that also involves textiles, working with textiles. How does that speak to your upbringing?
When you're in grad school, you try on a lot of different styles and a lot of, you're trying to find yourself, I think. And ultimately, for me, it was about like the lens in which you see the world, right, is affected by your cultural upbringing. You know, like you, there is no true, pure reality that we have access to. So I was thinking about the soup that I kind of stewed in, I guess. And, you know, I grew up pretty rural, pretty poor. And I was taught how to build a house and taught how to mend clothes and all that stuff, pretty, you know, like backwoodsy stuff. And for me, I wanted to bring all those things into one piece, you know, and like the clay kind of is me in this trifecta. It can be soft, it can be hard, it can be architectural, it can be expressive. And it all kind of just kind of gelled into this one format that really worked for me. I spend as much time sewing as I do like sculpting the clay. And for me, that's a very precious, intimate mark that's made each stitch, as opposed to like the, you know, the painting of the clay or the handling of that or the woodwork that goes into each piece, I think.
You know, Richard, you were just talking about the popularity of clay in recent years. I'm interested what any of you think. Do you think of there being a distinction between ceramics as art and ceramics as craft? And I wonder if you think it's changed over time as interest in working with clay has changed over time.
That is an endless argument that's been happening for 60 years.
Yeah, I think we've only entered another echelon of appreciation as art. I think it was for a long time tied to craft. It's it's this stepchild of sculpture. It's not made of important materials.
It's become incredibly passé in the art world to exclude craft from the ecology of contemporary art, though, now. Mm-hmm. I think it's in a really holistic way folded into what we think of as contemporary art. It's embraced it pretty wholly, and it may in some aspects exist on the outside of that idea, but there are just countless artists that use this vocabulary of craft. What's interesting about that is that it's about using the history of those crafts as well as the materials of those crafts. And there's a real, among other things, feminist component to that, because a lot of this work that we label as craft has been made anonymously throughout time, primarily by women, whereas the work by men has been attributed to individuals. And I think what's really great about the art world sort of vacuuming in this idea of craft, both commercially, academically, in every way, is that it acknowledges this vast history of makers that have gone unnamed. And I see that actually as one of the components that ties these three shows together. The other thing is that craft tends to be more ecumenical. Richard's work ties in all sorts of craft, including weaving into clay. Julie's work pulls in drawing and painting liberally. Pam's work pulls in an openness to material. These are three very ecumenical processes, very open to ideas.
Yeah, the idea of craft really, Glenn Adamson wrote a couple of books about the invention of craft and makes the argument that craft wasn't really a thing until the Industrial Revolution. Like it was part and parcel of making things. And then that was the kind of this split in the road where craft began to be appreciated for its own thing once the machines could make perfect replicas of whatever you needed.
Yeah. Pamela, what do you think?
Yeah, that's an age-old argument. I think they go hand in hand, and I think there's a lot of beautiful sculptural things that are made that are functional. So yeah, I think like Michael says, the lines between the two have been blurred, and that's a good thing.
Especially when you got a banana taped to a wall, you know, like there's always going to be that like response to that in some way, I think. And quote unquote capital A art, right, is becoming more and more conceptual, and shows are being designed on the back of a bar napkin in New York because you can't afford studio space, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's reputation and investment, and it's a tool to the market almost. And like, I think clay will always be this place for people who care about the process of doing that, because most of the people who come to the shows or appreciate clay are makers themselves, and they see the time that went into that, and they can understand that. And then as a avenue of connection that I don't think other materials have in that same way. I mean, I don't know if like just painters go to painting shows, but I think mostly there's clay people that go to clay shows, and they can kind of understand that work in a more intuitive way, I think.
So, yeah, I do think the intuition is what pulls us in. I don't, for myself, think that that kind of intellectual that little discussion about am I a craft person, it's just a material that's there and one I've enjoyed using. But I don't wrestle with that when I work.
Well, Michael, as we look ahead, what will we see coming out of the Westin? Where do you hope to take the gallery?
That's a thing that's still taking shape, I would say. But just as Dennis Harrington brought his experience and his ideas to the Westin for really almost 30 years, I think officially it was 29 years, this being the 30th year. You are all three part of our 30th anniversary, by the way. I bring a different sensibility, but not so different. There'll always be a dedication to artists that live and work in the region. I think that I would like to try to pair those artists with artists who aren't so connected to the region, but always a pairing. And this show acts as a kind of template for the idea of the power of pairing ideas and finding threads that connect them. And I think that will definitely continue at the Westin. I'm particularly interested in the upstairs space too, as a kind of projector of ideas into the center of this city. As I've been coming to the gallery more at night lately, and that's when it's more apparent to me. It's kind of shocking to me. And I love how there are two tiers to this gallery. There is that upstairs projector into the city, and then you enter this much more intimate space downstairs. You get two experiences in one at the Westin, which is kind of fascinating to me. For all the challenges of those spaces, they offer this other thing.
That fascination doesn't even have to happen when you walk through the door. You get to see the Westin when you're in your car driving by, and it's a remarkable thing.
It's blink every day of the year, essentially.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking with artists Julia Byrne, Pamela Hignite, Richard James, and Westin Art Gallery Director Michael Goodson. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All three exhibitions, Richard W. James, No True Scotsman, Julie Byrne, My Boat, and Pamela L. Hignite, Memory Keepers, run through January 19th, 2025 at the Westin Art Gallery in downtown Cincinnati. You can find a link with more information on our website, wbxu.org. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.